Live from Tehran, I am Bahman Nouri, and this is News.
Despite a ceasefire, Israel is pressing ahead with its attacks on the war-ravaged Gaza Strip with fresh strikes on Deir al-Balah, Khan Yunis and Gaza City. UNICEF says the regime has killed an average of 2 Palestinian children every day since the beginning of the ceasefire in mid-October. The total number of Palestinians killed since then has reached 312. Our correspondent Gada Ibrahim joined us earlier from Deir al-Balah to give us more details on the situation there.
The Israeli violations are continuous. Until this moment, we can still hear the Israeli attacks on the eastern walls of Deir al-Balah, on the eastern walls of Al-Bridge refugee camp, the eastern walls of Al-Maghazi, also the eastern walls of Khan Yunis, particularly the outskirts of Al-Qarara, Beni Sahela, and the Abasan areas, where the Israeli occupation army is still detonating the explosive-laden propulsion, leveling to the ground what remains of the buildings and the neighborhoods in these areas in order to level to the ground and in order to wipe out these areas completely. And it is worth mentioning that the Israeli occupation vehicles and armors has already widened the so-called yellow zone in a blatant violation of the ceasefire agreement. Many people are still forced to go displaced from the areas behind the so-called yellow line towards the western parts of the city. More attacks are taking place, particularly behind the so-called yellow line. More people are still falling victim to these attacks. More casualties, more killings, more injuries are still inflicting to the hospitals of the Gaza Strip, and most of the hospitals cannot deal with this overwhelming casualties and with the overwhelming lack and shortage of all the medical supplies, the fuel, and beds and in the field hospitals in particular.
Israeli forces have carried out fresh raids across the occupied West Bank. In Nablus, at least one Palestinian was killed, 3 people wounded and several others abducted. And in Beit Omar, north of Al-Khalil, Israeli forces abducted at least 55 Palestinians. For more details, we were earlier joined by our West Bank correspondent, Naka Hamad.
Let's start from Nablus, where the main focal point of the West Bank now is all of the eyes are now going towards Nablus, as the Israeli forces is clearly intending to widen the military operation against Nablus city. This comes after yesterday's assassination of the Palestinian policeman, actually, as the Israeli forces accuses him of firing ammunition against the Israeli soldiers, injuring at least three soldiers inside Nablus city. Since the hours of the morning, the Israeli forces have raided Nablus and started attacking the homes of the Palestinians. Among those who were arrested is the Palestinian PLC member Jamal Al-Tirawi and both of his sons, Muhammad and Abdul Hamid, after ransacking their home in Beit Umar in the north of occupied Al-Khalil. The situation is the same. Beit Umar have been under aggression, under a very hard aggression for the last 4 days now. Beit Umar faces a lot of military pressure and aggression, and the Israeli forces, after withdrawing from Beit Umar, they keep going into and out of Beit Umar.
Israel has carried out yet another drone strike on southern Lebanon as the regime continues to violate the ceasefire agreement with the Arab country. According to local media, one person was killed after an Israeli drone targeted a vehicle between the towns of Nabatia, Al-Fawqa and Zatar Sharkia. Lebanese authorities say the regime has committed 5,350 naval, ground and air violations since a ceasefire was agreed last November. During this period, 331 people have been killed and 945 wounded. For more on this, I'm now joined by our correspondent on the ground in Beirut, in the south of Lebanon, Hadi Hotate. Hadi, very good to have you on the program. What are the latest?
Yes, actually a very tragic morning that started today in the village of Zoltar in South Lebanon. So after the drone strike targeted the car, the minivan on the road, it was the people here circulated a photo of his parents, the mother and father, who were just 100 meters away from the targeting location, and they saw how their son was cold-bloodedly executed by Israeli drone strikes just in front of their eyes. This, of course, led to very big anger among the people of Zawtar village, and of course, people of South Lebanon. Their anger is growing against the fact that the Lebanese authorities, who claim to be guaranteeing a ceasefire, is doing nothing in front of the daily killing of their sons on the street. This is added to another attack by a quadcopter that happened today on Shakra village. I can say that this is also one of the first attacks on Shakra village. It's a second line village after Hula and Meis el Jebel. And an Israeli quadcopter dropped a bomb on the square inside the village, and five civilians were just casually gathered. They were injured by the shrapnels from that bomb, and they were taken to nearby hospitals. And thank God their injuries are not severe, according to the information we have until now. So this means that this morning we have one martyred and five others injured in Israeli attacks, and we are not even, we didn't reach the half of the midday today. And this is added to also another strike that is less than 24 hours from now. Yesterday, the Israelis at night, they targeted a car on Frun, the road between Frun and Qaqa'it al-Jisr and Tawayri. The attack also led to the martyrdom of one local from Frun. Now, we have to mention that martyrs are locals. They are from those villages. They are living in those villages. For example, the martyr of today's attack on Zawtar, he is from Qarambash family, and he is a local of Zawtar. And yesterday also he was the local of Frun, and he was also, he had a social position among the people of Frun. He was one of the people responsible for social activism in Frun, and always the Israelis link this type of position to they call it the attempts of Hezbollah to rebuild its infrastructure, but on the ground, they are attempts from the locals and from the people to stay in their villages and to not be intimidated or terrorized by those terrorist daily attacks that Israel is insisting on committing on daily basis, only to keep the people of South Lebanon under this type of psychological pressure and to keep this tragic situation continuing since more than 11 months. It has been continuous since last year's quote-unquote ceasefire started.
Right, thank you so much, Hadi, for the update. Hadi Hotay joining us from south of Lebanon. New York Mayor-elect Zoran Mamdani has once again called out Israel for committing genocide in Gaza and criticized the U.S. for funding it.
I've spoken about the Israeli government committing genocide, and I've spoken about our government funding it. And I shared with the president in our meeting about the concern that many New Yorkers have of wanting their tax dollars to go towards the benefit of New Yorkers and their ability to afford basic dignity.
Mamdani made the comments in his first meeting with President Donald Trump at the Oval Office. He noted that New Yorkers were tired of seeing their tax dollars fund endless wars and human rights violations. He argued that those funds should instead be redirected to address basic needs at home. Mamdani is the first Muslim and first South Asian mayor of New York City. He maintained a strong pro-Palestinian stance in his electoral campaign. A group of U.S. congressional Democrats say threats against them have surged dramatically after President Trump suggested their comments were punishable by death. The six lawmakers condemned Trump's remarks as dangerous, warning they amount to threats against elected officials. All of the lawmakers have served in the military or intelligence community. On Tuesday, they released a video urging military service members to resist any unlawful orders. In response, Trump posted a series of messages on Truth Social, accusing them of seditious behavior and repeating that their comments were punishable by death. The White House, however, insists that Trump's posts were not intended as threats. In a radio interview, Trump also said he's not threatening death to the Democrats, but thinks they're in serious trouble. The United Nations has urged the U.S. to lift decades-old sanctions on Cuba, warning of the severe impact on the island's population.
I call on the United States to lift or suspend all unilateral coercive measures applied onto Cuba and Cuban companies, including the 10% rule, application of jurisdiction on the base of payment of U.S. dollars, prohibition for vessels to enter the U.S. ports for 180 days after entering ports of Cuba, and threats to revoke visas or FITA eligibility.
Duhan further emphasized that the embargo has deteriorated all sectors in Cuba due to the trade and financial curbs. She said the U.S. sanctions violate international norms and have worsened Cuba's humanitarian crisis. Last month, an overwhelming majority of UN member states adopted a resolution for the 33rd consecutive year calling for an end to the economic blockade. Cuba has faced deep economic and energy turmoil since 2020, with shrinking GDP, soaring inflation, food shortages, and rolling blackouts. Hundreds of Japanese people have gathered outside Prime Minister Sanae Takaichi's residence in Tokyo, demanding she retract her recent remarks on Taiwan and issue an apology. Protesters carried banners reading retract remarks, oppose war, and Takaichi stepped down while chanting slogans against militarism. Opposition groups, including the Social Democratic Party, denounced the comments as provocative and dangerous. They warned the comments risk dragging Japan into war and undermining regional peace. Takaichi had claimed that China's possible use of force on Taiwan could pose a survival-threatening situation for Japan, implying armed intervention. She has refused to withdraw the statement, insisting it reflected government policy. China has condemned the remarks as erroneous, warning that Japan is accelerating rearmament. Beijing insists Taiwan is part of its territory and has vowed reunification, even by force if necessary. In Italy, clashes erupted between police and protesters in the northern city of Bologna as thousands took to the streets to protest against the presence of an Israeli basketball team in the city. Police fired tear gas and used water cannons to disperse demonstrators who were chanting slogans in support of the people of Palestine and waving Palestinian flags. Protesters denounced the decision to hold a match between Virtus Bologna and Maccabi Tel Aviv in the city. They called for Israel to be suspended from international sports competitions. The demonstration comes amid growing anti-Israeli sentiments in the world over the regime's crimes in Gaza, with activists urging a boycott of Israeli sports teams. In recent months, the participation of Israeli sports teams in European competitions has sparked protests in many cities. Russian President Vladimir Putin said Moscow has received U.S.'s peace proposals for Ukraine, adding the plan could form a basis for resolving the conflict.
We have this text of U.S. proposed peace plan. We received it through existing channels of communication with the U.S. administration. I believe it can be used as the basis of a final peaceful settlement, but it has not been discussed with us in detail, and I can guess why. The reason is the same. The U.S. administration has so far failed to secure Ukraine's consent.
Mr. Putin added that Ukraine rejected the plan and argued that neither Kyiv nor European powers grasped the reality of Russian advances on the battlefield. He warned that without peace talks, Ukraine will inevitably lose more territory, like the recently captured city of Kupiansk. The Russian leader emphasized that while military operations continue to achieve Moscow's objectives, he remains open to negotiations. Putin said a peaceful resolution requires detailed discussions of the U.S. proposals and that Russia is prepared to engage in such talks. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky, on the other hand, says the country is facing one of the most difficult moments in its history, warning that Kyiv may be forced into a painful choice.
Right now is one of the most difficult moments in our history. The pressure on Ukraine is one of the hardest. Ukraine may face a very difficult choice, either the loss of dignity or the risk of losing a key partner, either the complex 28 points or an extremely harsh winter, the harshest, with further risks.
Addressed to the nation, the Ukrainian president also stressed that he won't betray his country's national interests. He said he will propose alternatives to the plan put forward by the Trump administration. A 28-point peace plan drafted by the U.S. has reportedly called for Ukraine to give up the entire Donbas region, limit the size of its military, and prohibit any foreign troop presence in its territory. The draft is also believed to suggest the use of $100 billion of frozen Russian assets for a U.S.-led effort to reconstruct Ukraine. It rules out NATO membership for Kyiv while keeping the EU path open. The deal also demands snap elections for Ukraine in 100 days. And that is a wrap for this hour's news bulletin. Thank you so much for staying with us.
Today's special. special for you, we present to you today. In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful, dear brother and sister, Salaamu Alaikum and welcome to a new episode of Today's Special from IRIB English Radio. Thank you for choosing this program to listen to. And inshallah, this program would be beneficial for you. Today, we're going to speak about modern idolatry.
Yourself, can't you see this wonder spread in front of you? The clouds floating by, the sky so clear and blue, planets in their orbits, the moon and the sun, such perfect harmony. Let's start questioning ourselves, isn't this proof enough for us?
But first, as the usual, we look at the calendar. Today is Saturday, 1st of Jamadi al-Thani, 1447 of the Islamic Lunar Hijri calendar, corresponding to the 1st of the month of Azar, 1404 of the Solar calendar, and the 22nd of November, 2025 of the Christian Gregorian calendar. And as the ritual of this program, we bless our moments by listening to a verse from the Holy Quran. For today, we listen to verse 3 of chapter At-Talaq. Then we come back to the studio and we know more about this verse.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. ويرزقه من حيث لا يحتسب ومن يتوكل على الله فهو حسبه إن الله بالغ أمره قد جعل الله لكل شيء قدرا.
And will provide for him from where he does not expect. And whoever relies upon Allah, then he is sufficient for him. Indeed, Allah will accomplish His purpose. Allah has already set for everything a decreed extent.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Bless your day with contemplation on the verses of the Holy Quran.
The blessed verse is saying that Allah will provide him from sources that he could have never imagined, and whosoever puts his trust in Allah, he will suffice him, since Allah will accomplish his purpose, and Allah has set a measure for all things. Thus, male and female witnesses are warned against entertaining fear of problems resulting from treading the path of truth, but they are enjoined to administer justice and invoke Allah for removing the impediments, since He guarantees that whoever puts his trust in Him, he will be delivered from entanglements.
Life is not the same when I'm too concerned by what they say. Why should I wanna have you to doubt you? Stay deep inside, I know that amidst all the darkness and everything which makes no sense, I know that you exist. You are the light that guides me through my darkest nights, shows me right from wrong in life, a world that often lies. Cause I don't need anyone.
So we go straightly toward modern idolatry and the effects of this phenomena in our life. In the contemporary era, the concept of idolatry has evolved, transcending physical boundaries to encompass virtual realms. The proliferation of social media and digital platforms has given rise to new forms of idolization, where individuals and entities are revered and emulated online. This phenomenon warrants a profound examination through the lens of Quranic teachings, which provide a rich and enduring framework for understanding the complexities of idolatry in both its ancient and hyper-modern contexts.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. This is Ali Hawes. Today we are going to talk about modern idolatry in 2025. With regard to modern idolatry, we can refer to one important case of it. There are lots of examples for this modern idolatry, but the most important that we want to talk about today is feng shui or superstition. Is it a superstition or reality? This is what we want to discuss today. Perhaps ever since humanity in the 21st century distanced itself from the divine foundations, and with the rapid progress of science, drifted away from spirituality to the point of reaching depression, mankind has sought a self-made spirituality, one through which a person could craft an ideal world and attain the happiness he desires. However, in our environment too, it can sometimes be heard that the certain people, in pursuit of an imaginary happiness, are drawn towards colorful but hollow forms of mysticism, like that of feng shui. Feng shui is among the phenomena which, after several years of activity, has managed to attract followers. But to what extent feng shui is based on truth or superstition is the subject of our discussion today.
Special topics for a special program. You can listen today, now and here, IRIB English Radio. Today is a special. This feeling of love, just let it grow forever through your life.
Bring beautiful years of joy between you till the end of time. This is today's special, and we'll look at one of the hidden ways of committing shirk. That is showing off. Yes, in our current age, few things are as common as showing off. A lot of people want everyone to see what they are up to, so that they know that they too are progressing in life. We show off our personal lives so that our friends, relatives, and colleagues know that we are not losers. We show off our good deeds so that people know that we are charitable. The point is that a large number of people are growing accustomed to showing off themselves for the validation of other people and to be seen in a good light by others. Of all the ways by which we show off, showing off our good deeds is an act of shirk. Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and his family said, "The thing I fear most for you is a lesser shirk or polytheism, showing off of good deeds." So how to protect ourselves from shirk? One way could be learning and understanding Tawheed deeply. The first protection from shirk is knowledge. When you truly understand what Tawheed means, that Allah alone deserves worship, love, fear, and reliance, you naturally reject anything that competes with Him. Study the meanings of Allah's names and attributes. Reflect on His power, His mercy, His wisdom. When your heart knows Allah well, it becomes impossible to associate anything with Him. Read books or attend online courses on Islamic aqidah or belief, especially those examining oneness in worship and oneness in lordship. The stronger your understanding, the safer you are from hidden forms of shirk.
With regard to modern idolatry, we want to talk about the idols that we make newly, and we don't know about the reality of them. Are they really sacred or no? They're just superstition. These are the things that we need to discuss. So in this show, we shall actually target and address only one example of these idolatry. But hopefully we can find some time in future to discuss other examples as well. So let's discuss that if feng shui is a superstition or reality. According to its definition, feng shui, meaning wind and water, is an ancient Chinese philosophy and art used to arrange furniture and objects in home, shops, gardens, and other places to influence health, joy, success, harmony, and the overall flow of positive qi energy. The main principle include avoiding clutter, using suitable colors and curved lines, and observing proper directions. However, today, feng shui is officially considered superstition in China. When visiting shops that sell feng shui products, one often encounters statements like, "This item brings blessings to your home. This symbol will strengthen your relationship with your spouse," or "this statue moves its spirit around the room at night and changes the energy." These claims arise a common question: how could a mere statue or symbol produce such effects? To explore how widely feng shui symbols are sold, we visited several statue stores. One female shopkeeper whose store was filled with various figures, including Buddha statues and three-legged frogs. When asked whether she personally believed in feng shui, she answered, "No, I don't. It's nothing but superstition." It's interesting.
Dear brother and sister, we open a new chapter here, and that was about modern idolatry, one of the great and important phenomena in modern life. I think it's better to continue this interesting topic on the next episodes of today's special from IRIB English Radio. So be with us, and till then, we leave you in Allah's mercy. Fi amanillah.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Hello and welcome back to Attrition. I'm your host, Amar Kazmi, and I continue to be joined for part two of the show with British-Palestinian medical doctor Rahma Al-Adwan. Rahma, you've repeatedly said that we need to free Palestine and Britain from Jewish supremacy. So what's your analysis of how and why the British state has been captured by Zionists?
The Jewish lobby exerts its influence with coercion. So if they're not blackmailing, they are funding. If they're not funding, they are threatening. If they're not threatening, they're infiltrating. It is usually one of those things. How they captured my general medical counsel, I truly believe that my case was being put in the hands of people who were going to take them further. Dr. Rehana Ali is a great example of this. Her case was rejected, the exact same complaint was rejected, I think, 2 to 3 times before it was put in the right hands of that person, that investigation officer, that case examiner, who then brought it forwards. So that's infiltration. That is Jewish supremacists, whether they're Jews or non-Jews, but they are enforcing Jewish supremacy inside our institutions. MPs-wise, they're funded, but not only just funded. You know, Wesley Streeting has been basically groomed by the Jewish lobby since he was young. When he was at uni, the Jewish Chronicle printed an article to say that he was their friend at the NUS.
The National Union of Students.
Yeah. Wesley Streeting is a case in point, because I think obviously right now there's talks about potentially him taking over from Keir Starmer. I think if Wesley Streeting in any way, shape or form becomes Prime Minister in Britain, then you know Britain is absolutely completely controlled by Israel and the Jewish lobby, because he has been fully groomed from when he was younger. They take them on trips to Israel. That's another key thing. So many of our MPs, through Labour Friends of Israel and Conservative Friends of Israel, they take our British MPs to that entity. God knows what they do there, but they come back and then it becomes Israel first. It is just no longer Britain first. You know, there's videos of Nandi.
Lisa Nandi.
Yeah, from 2018, talking about Palestine. And then now she's like, Israel first. You know, she refuses to even speak about Palestine
and she was also previously chair of Labour Friends of Palestine as well.
Exactly. So something happens there, and it's usually that trip and some money.
And the issue you raised of coercion, intimidation, blackmail is very important, because quite clearly, if you don't fall in line and support the Zionist regime, these lobby groups have the power to harass, intimidate, to destroy your career. And we see with your case how they've tried to destroy your medical career. And so if you want to get on in British public life, it seems that you have to be a Zionist, and also to go on the offensive against Muslims, Palestinians and Arabs.
Well, totally. You know, this is far beyond me as a person, far beyond me with my medical license. I think if any lobby group is able to ruin the life of a doctor in a nation who has not harmed anybody and not broken any law, then we're in a lot of trouble. If they can do that to me, then any British citizen is next. You know, this is the end of free speech in Britain. You know, this is the demise of our, not only our independence, that's already gone. We're already captured. But this is now about our ability to speak freely, our freedom of assembly, our freedom of speech and expression. That is what is right now being attacked in Britain by the Jewish lobby.
I want to get into the details of the General Medical Council's case against you. I appreciate that there's a lot to recap, but could you explain, in summary, the level of harassment that you've been facing with this case?
Sure. You said the General Medical Council's sort of campaign against me. It is, it might appear that way, but I think it's literally me versus the Jewish lobby, because the General Medical Council is just, it's not an independent regulator. So they initiated an investigation on me last year. That was 9 months long. I responded, case closed, no outcome. They had to tell lawyers for Israel, she's not a quote-unquote anti-Semite and she's not a terrorist supporter, so that's it. Then, again, this is the incessant harassment and complaints of the Jewish lobby. They kept going and harassing the General Medical Council. A second investigation was opened in May this year, 2025. But this time, even worse, they kept complaining to the point where the GMC referred me to what is called an interim orders tribunal hearing, which is an emergency. It is an extreme measure where the General Medical Council go, well, we're investigating you for these allegations, but as we investigate you, actually we think you should be suspended or you should have conditions placed on your practice. So that happened. I went to the hearing on the 25th of September and I defended with my legal team. I defended a bundle of about 450 pages and I came out and the panel found no reason to place any order on my practice. So I won that. 12 days later, the General Medical Council re-referred me again to this hearing, this emergency hearing that actually a lot of doctors who have actually physically harmed patients through their practice might never actually be referred to an IOT hearing. That's where I am at the moment. So I'm facing a second IOT hearing in my second investigation for exactly the same issues that the Jewish lobby does not like. And all this shows is that I have been exonerated at every single level of investigation up until today. I've won everything against them, yet somehow I'm still being painted as this evil villain.
And you've said that these IOT hearings, these interim orders tribunal hearings, are only for really extreme cases in relation to patient care. But in your case, it's purely in relation to social media posts.
So the IOT hearing is an emergency measure because it is saying that whilst the GMC investigate, you can't practice as a doctor, which means that the GMC, through the tribunal, will remove you from being able to care for the British public. That's why it's an extreme measure, because whilst you investigate, you're saying that whether this takes 2 months or 9 months like my first, this doctor is not able to treat the British public and care for them. That's an extreme because that is a negative for the British public. But the GMC are willing to do that and to take moral doctors away from the British public because the Jewish lobby says so. I think that's why it's I don't think people understand why it is an emergency measure. There's incidents where doctors are being investigated for misconduct, for potential patient harm, for alleged inappropriateness, with patients who might not get an IOT hearing. Yet I am being referred for a second one, again for a speech for, like you say, social media. It's making a mockery of our medical regulation.
Well, I think your case really highlights the nature of Jewish supremacy in Britain, because you can just contrast the way that you've been treated with the way that some other Jewish doctors have been treated. So if we take the case of Dr. Justin Stebbing, in 2020, he was investigated by the General Medical Council over allegations that he failed to provide adequate care to 11 patients that he cared for. He admitted to 30 of the 36 charges against him. He was found guilty of another three. He was found to have inappropriately treated patients given their poor prognosis, overstated life expectancy and benefits of treatment, failed to gain informed consent by not discussing the risks and benefits of treatments, and failed to maintain proper records. He was also found to have engaged in inappropriate communications with a female patient. But he was only suspended for 9 months, and he wasn't even struck off, and he didn't even get referred to an IOT hearing like you've been. And then you have Dr. Liz Lightstone, who, in my view, has engaged in open Islamophobia and denial of the genocide in Gaza, but no action has been taken against her. This is a two-tier system, isn't it?
The two-tier system in Britain is that there is one treatment for Jews and another for non-Jews. That is what my case highlights very, very clearly. You mentioned the two Jewish doctors, Justin Stebbing and Liz Lightstone. Despite what you've mentioned with their misconduct, and I call it anti-Muslim hatred, I don't like the term Islamophobia either. So yeah, it's not just the terms about, you know, Jews that I contest. But they have the chutzpah, the audacity, to complain about me. Those are the two complaints. Justin Stebbing is who kick-started my second investigation.
Well, it was remiss of me to not mention that, actually, that Dr. Justin Stebbing is one of the prime complainants against you. And as you say, he has the sheer audacity, the chutzpah, to be complaining about you when he was found guilty of misconduct in the course of his practice as a doctor, not for social media posts.
Yeah, it is the chutzpah. You know, him and Liz Lightstone, I wouldn't want them anywhere near me or my loved ones. Straight, you know, I am not afraid to say quite loud and clearly that if there is a Israeli or a part Israeli British doctor, I do not want them anywhere near me or my loved ones. And if there's a doctor that supports, you know, who supports Israel, I too do not want them I don't want them anywhere near me in terms of medical treatment, because I think having that position is the most sort of antithetical to our medical ethics. But yeah, those two doctors, one of them Stebbing, you know, a record of misconduct and terrible behavior and dishonesty, recurrent dishonesty. That's what the MPTS actually said about him, that he was consistently dishonest. And that is what he wrote for me in the complaint that he made to the GMC. He called me dishonest.
Every accusation is a confession when it comes to the Zionists.
100%. It is just such Jewish supremacist behavior. Liz Lightstone, I did, I think, two posts about her atrocious a justification or alleged justification of murdering Palestinian journalists and medics, and she went ahead and complained about me. So there's a complaint from her in this bundle now from Liz Lightstone, and she sent that complaint while she was holidaying in the terrorist entity. It is just, oh, and another one is Dr. Miriam Green. She is the Jewish doctor that I worked with at the Whittington last year, who went behind my back. I didn't know that she did this, but she complained to the Whittington. She complained to my seniors. She was my junior, right? Never had an issue with her face to face. She complained to my trust. She complained to my seniors. She lied about me in the Daily Mail with the Sabrina Miller article, which ended up creating this huge campaign against me, getting me doxed, me having to call the police. Dr. Miriam Green, I mentioned her when I defended myself against her lies in the Daily Mail. She called the police, saying that I was sort of sharing her details online when I was defending myself against her lies. And not only that, she complained to the Jewish Medical Association, who, in their complaint last time, said that I was doxing her, that I doxed Miriam Green. Miriam Green, who got me sacked from the Whittington, who lied about me in the Daily Mail, getting me to the point where I feared for my life and my family's life, and who called the police on me for defending myself against her. Apparently I'm doxing her. So I'm going to continue to say her name because it's not doxing. It just shows you the arrogance, the behavior, the feeling untouchable, you know, that is somebody I wouldn't want to care for me or my loved ones, you know. And not just that. After my hearing, now for this second hearing, lawyers for Israel are also saying that I'm harassing and doxing Miriam Green. It just comes up constantly, even though I made a few posts about her. That's
I mean, this type of behavior is absolutely typical of Zionists. I mean, I mentioned before that every accusation is a confession and that they perpetuate a position of victimhood while actually being perpetrators of aggression against others. We should also talk about your arrest on the 18th of October. This was just days before you had a tribunal hearing. It's quite clear to me that you were arrested at the behest of the Israel lobby and probably also the British Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, who, in my view, is a Zionist fanatic and an asset of the Zionist regime. I just want to read out some of what the arresting officer said, because it's pretty sinister. So they started by saying, on the 21st of July, at a pro-Palestine protest which took place outside of the Foreign and Commonwealth Office, you gave a speech which amounted to calls for the eradication of Israel and implied support for all those involved in armed resistance against Israel, including organizations such as Hamas. So firstly, it's not illegal to call for the eradication of a nation state. And it's also perfectly lawful to support armed resistance against the Zionist state, because Palestinians have that right under international law. They then started talking about the pro-Israel MP Wes Streeting, and they also said that you were being arrested for comments directed at him that could be interpreted as anti-Semitic, including anti-Semitic tropes, which could be grossly offensive in character. I mean, Wes Streeting isn't even Jewish, so it's very, very strange. And then they said, on the 7th of October, you posted a variety of communications which demonstrated support for Hamas's attack on Israel. So, firstly, it wasn't a Hamas attack. It was actually a coordinated operation between all factions of the Palestinian resistance, including the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, the PFLP, which is not proscribed in Britain, and also its armed wing is not proscribed in Britain. They then carried on, an attack which involved murder, rape, even though there's zero evidence of rape, right? That's just blatant atrocity propaganda. And then they continued, and kidnap of Israeli citizens, which could be considered grossly offensive in character. This looks like a charge sheet written directly by the Zionist state, or indeed by Wes Streeting, on their behalf, and then sent to the police. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, totally. My arrest before 2 days before my hearing was completely ordered by either straight from Tel Aviv, or at least certainly from the Jewish lobby in Britain. The police were just—they're just pawns. You know, there is just no British independence. We don't have a sovereign Britain. The allegations that the police said, if you change Israel for Britain, I wouldn't have been arrested. I could have said that I don't want Britain to exist, and I could have made all of those remarks about Britain. I would not have been arrested. That is Jewish supremacy. I could, you know, that is the two tier. But the British state is allowing itself to just be used by this power to enforce something that Jewish supremacy only benefits 0.4% of the British population, because 0.4% are Jewish. Now, obviously, some of those Jews might not engage in Jewish supremacy, but it's still there, open for them. So I think it's time that the British public kind of wakes up to this. You have a doctor who is British, who has never harmed a patient, who has an unblemished record, being doxed, harassed, smeared, arrested for a foreign entity. And now we are looking at potential changes to the law because of Wesley Streeting, saying that you are guilty before you're innocent. If you're accused of anti-Semitism only, you can be accused of being a murderer or a rapist, but you are innocent until you're found guilty. But if you're accused of anti-Semitism, then you will, in the NHS, you will be guilty, you'll be suspended whilst you're being investigated. That couldn't be anything but Jewish supremacy. And he's meddling into our independent panels. So there's no finality of justice if you're found to be innocent, but Jewish supremacists think, nope, you're guilty. Our politicians and our institutions will retry you. And if the Jewish lobby is not happy with you, if you're threatening, if you're saying things that threatens their supremacy, then you're guilty before you're found innocent. I mean, that's outrageous.
I just want to add something briefly about that in terms of Wes Streeting's intervention. Number one, he's the health secretary. He's a member of the British government. If we're supposed to have a separation of powers, then why is he meddling in the internal affairs of a professional regulator and how they decide to govern the medical profession? But nevertheless, he appears to have threatened legal action if they don't give him the decision that he wants. And in response to your victory at the Interim Orders Tribunal, before they re-referred you to another tribunal, he announced a government review on tackling anti-Semitism and other forms of racism in the NHS. And who did he appoint to conduct that review? He appointed the Zionist zealot Lord John Mann. Now, John Mann, until 2021, and he might have accepted more donations since then, but what I know is that during his long political career, until 2021, he'd accepted £36,815.92 in donations and junkets from the Israel lobby. And this is the person who has now been put in charge of a review into supposed anti-Semitism in the NHS directly because of your victory. So that just gives you an indication of the state of things. But I want to steer away from all of that now and lastly speak about the Thawabit. So these are the red lines in campaigning for Palestinian liberation. Could you just explain, for the benefit of our viewers, what are the Thawabit and why should we insist on them in the campaigning that we do here in the West?
The Thawabit are the non-negotiables, or the constants, the red lines of Palestinian liberation. They're derived from the Palestinian National Charter that has 33 articles. This is what they don't want you to know about. The Palestinian National Charter was agreed on in 1968 by all Palestinian factions and the Arab League. And it is the most pure, authentic Palestinian nationalist voice. And that is what the Palestinian National Charter lists, what is required in order to have national freedom and sovereignty in Palestine by Palestinians. It contains all the answers that anybody could have to questions that they may go and ask maybe a liberal or, you know, somebody in the West. Palestinians have already set that out. If you asked most people in the movement, in the Palestine movement in the West, if they have read those 33 articles, when I say article, it's just a few lines each, in the Palestinian National Charter, I doubt that many of them would have. And that is where I think the movement has been subverted. And those articles are what we derive the Thawabit from. The Thawabit are basically four principles. It can be 4 to 6, depending how you word them, that are just non-negotiable.